We have Terry Moore. Terry is a principal with the Helmuth & Johnson Law Firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where he advises business leaders on matters ranging from strategic thinking to contracts to litigation. Terry has been practicing constitutional law for over 30 years. Terry has represented individuals, businesses, and classes in state and federal courts, including the Eighth Circuit and state Supreme Courts, on many constitutional issues, including First Amendment, due process, illegal taxation, and other issues. Terry has received many awards, including Attorney of the Year and the Minnesota State Bar Association's highest award, the President's Award. Terry argued in front of the North Dakota Supreme Court in Sorum v. State and will be presenting today on constitutional issues cited in that case. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I should say good morning, clients. If any of you are taxpayers of the state of North Dakota, you are our clients in the recently decided Sorum versus State of North Dakota. Quick procedural posture in the district court. Well, background on the statute. I'll simplify. I realize I'm following the pot princess. I'm ahead of lunch. We'll get this done. So, basically, in 2017, the North Dakota legislature passed an act that said the state of North Dakota no longer owns the riverbed of the Missouri River / Lake Sakakawea above the pre-Garrison Dam 1953 ordinary high water mark. It also gave away $187 million in refunds because that had been collected on royalties for leases since 2006, mineral leases in the area. So as a taxpayer's lawyers, we sought to have the statute declared unconstitutional. Number of theories, but we're going to focus on the anti-gift clause because that's how the court decided the case. And really, if you're going to pass, if we always felt if we didn't win the anti-gift clause, the other stuff wasn't going to help us. So we went to district court where the taxpayers and the state cross-moved for summary judgment. Taxpayers win an injunction and a finding of unconstitutionality on about $187 million of refunds. State wins summary judgment on 96,000 acres. Basically, the district court, well, we don't even have to go into the district court's reasons for its decisions because both sides appealed. And the taxpayers did not get the result we would have hoped for. We'll talk more about that. We have, the decision came out about 2-3 weeks ago. We filed a petition for rehearing on Thursday of last week. We're waiting to be granted that petition for rehearing because they are granted so often. But here's what came out of this case. We got hundreds of millions given away. We got billions of dollars worth of mineral rights. But this case may go down 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now for the decision the court made on the standard for a facial challenge. Now, I presume everybody who's attending and listening to this conference has an idea what that is, but I'll explain it anyway. A facial challenge, of course, is one where the challenge to the statute is it is unconstitutional on its face. There's no constitutional way or application to it, and it has to be stricken down. The other type of challenge is an as-applied challenge, which is the statute may be generally constitutional, but it's unconstitutional as applied to me. So taxpayers, if they're challenging a statute, always challenge the statute as a facial challenge. as were we. Now, there's a 1987 case, U.S. Supreme Court case, called U.S. versus Salerno. Now, in that case, which was a pretty routine facial challenge case, toward the end, in dicta, there's a comment by the court that says, in a facial challenge, it will succeed only if there is no application of the law which could be constitutional. Now, this has been much criticized and also much quoted around the country. Federal district courts, courts of appeal, state courts. And in North Dakota, coming into this case, before our case was filed, the North Dakota Supreme Court had addressed Salerno on two occasions, both in the last 5 years. One was called the Larimer case. And by the way, quick aside, I talk about a lot of cases. I've got all the citations. I think they're being distributed. It's just a list of the citations, so I don't have to continue to cite them and further distract from myself. So, in the Larimer case, there's a horrible school bus accident. The families of the injured challenged the constitutionality of the municipal liability cap. The Supreme Court quoted Salerno and said, well, if the injuries were under the threshold, it would be constitutional. And the fact that yours happened to be over doesn't make it unconstitutional because there is a constitutional application. Citing Salerno, not dwelling on it, kind of in passing, but important to the decision, critical to the decision. And then later that year, a year or so later, I should say, the court had the Schoon case. Now, I thought this was interesting as we were briefing the Salerno, which we'll talk about more in a minute. In the Schoon case, I thought the court really didn't have to address Salerno. It was a facial challenge, and they had decided it. And then the court came in and said, quoting U.S. Supreme Court cases, saying the Supreme Court cases complaining call it, for example, one calls it a fictional standard. Another one says that it is not the test for viability on a facial challenge. This comes right out. It's been cited many, many times on both sides. So in the Schoon case, the North Dakota Supreme Court didn't touch Salerno itself, but talked about cases that complained about Salerno and quoted saying, the normal facial challenge, we look at a statute by provision. The normal thing is, if part of it is unconstitutional, we will declare the facial challenge successful and strike down that point, leaving in those points that would be constitutional. This would have been a dagger in the heart of Salerno in North Dakota for the facial challenge standard, except the court didn't say, we hereby don't accept Salerno. So come now to Sorum versus State. The taxpayers have challenged, among other things, the giveaway of $187 million in refunds collected from 25,000 leases dating back to the 70s, and the abdication of all mineral rights in 96,000 mineral acres in the Missouri River / Lake Sakakawea. Okay? We said, well, state owns it. Act gives it away. violates the anti-gift clause. If you can't give a Supreme Court argument in three steps, figure it out, you got to get another argument. So the state said, no, under Salerno, the state, in order to violate the anti-gift clause, have to own all 96,000 acres. So if there are 10 acres in there that the state doesn't own, well, it would be constitutional because the statute doesn't give that away because we don't own it. And this is, as I said, we had some fun arguments to make on that. For example, one of the arguments was, well, would it be constitutional if the state gave away all its mineral rights on dry land in North Dakota? I'm sorry, in Williams County, North Dakota, because private people own some other mineral rights. We argued, would it be okay for the state to give away all its money in a certain bank because others had money in the same bank that the state didn't own? So that's really where the argument came down to at the Supreme Court, at the oral argument. And I'm happy to say we won that issue. But when I say this is where it will be, Sorum versus State might have serious constitutional impact over the next generation, is they took on Salerno, they took on that state argument I just recited, and they said in no uncertain words that you cannot make a statute constitutional by adding, you can't save the constitutionality of a statute by that's partly unconstitutional by adding constitutional aspects. So we did win that issue. Anyway, taxpayers. So the decision went on to talk about the Submerged Land Act. And this is where the court, I believe, made a mistake of law. But having decided that the argument wasn't constitutional, I'm sorry, the state's argument was not viable, the court went on to find that the state never owned the money in SIF, $187 million, didn't own the 25,000 leases it had been signed on to and collecting on since the 70s, didn't own any of the 96,000 acres. Therefore, the state can't violate the gift clause by giving away what it never owned in the first instance. Well, how do you find that the state didn't own the land? Well, first of all, you have to look at what was our argument? Why did they own the land and the mineral rights and the money? Okay. 1953, the Submerged Land Act said any federal federal lands beneath waters acquired by the federal government for purposes of navigation, read the Garrison Dam. No question that the Submerged Land Act, federal act, applies to the 96,000 acres we're talking about. Okay, it said all that riverbed, all that lakebed, if the water's navigable, federal government is giving it to the state. So we thought that was a pretty good reason for ownership. Then our second argument on ownership was 1989 State Sovereign Lands Act, and we'll get more back to the Submerged Land Act later because that's critical. 1989 Sovereign Land Act said all the beds of navigable waters are hereby transferred to the state. It's self-executing, da-da-da-da. So, all right, that's our second nail. Then 1979, we had the Furlong case, 91, the Mills 1 case, 99, the Mills 2 case, 2016, the Reap case, all saying If it's navigable water, the state owns up to the ordinary high water mark as it changes from time to time, as affected by the Garrison Dam. So that's our third nail. And we felt pretty good. And really, if the court finds that the state owns this money, these mineral rights, then we almost have to win the case, because it's absolutely, the state makes no bones about, we don't own any of this anymore. So back to the Submerged Land Act. And this is where I believe the court made an error of law, and is what we briefed on our petition for rehearing. Under the Submerged Land Act, there's a grant, Section 1311, for those of you keeping score. There's a grant of all the lands that I talked about before. However, under Section 1313, there's an exception. There is an exception to the grant. In other words, federal government is giving the states everything except anything that they've acquired in a proprietary capacity. Well, what's a proprietary capacity? What does that mean? Well, the Submerged Land Act tells us in Section 1314, they talk about paramount capacity and proprietary capacity. Paramount capacity is, in our case, navigation, but think of broad governments, international affairs, things that are paramount. Whatever the whatever else the government gives to the states, the federal government, they cannot give these away, right? The control of navigation, the common defense, the international trade, interstate commerce, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are paramount. Proprietary capacity, in our case, you can think of it as the development of the minerals. A proprietary capacity is what a private person might do if they owned the land. The government bought this building so that we could build an office to house government employees. Okay, that's proprietary. Those kind of development, commerce, use of government where it's acting as a commercial capacity, etc. So, under the exception, remember, government gives us everything except what it keeps. It's keeping what's in a proprietary capacity. So, we need to figure out whether that is a proprietary capacity in which they bought the land, or a paramount capacity. Well, that, we get there and it gets pretty easy, because the Flood Control Act, Flood Control Act of 1944 authorized the Garrison Dam, authorized the acquisition of all this property that we're talking about. In 1944, the Flood Control Act says in a lengthy purpose statement, its purpose is navigation and flood control. Paramount activities. But then it gets even easier when we say, well, in 1944, nobody knew there was oil in the Bakken. There was no technology for retrieving submerged minerals. Nobody was thinking about oil at all. Did they get this to control navigation and flooding, or did they get this land to develop the minerals underneath? Well, if you want a clincher, in 1951, when oil was discovered in the Bakken, at that point, the federal government stopped acquiring the mineral rights. So the federal government did not get this land in order to develop the minerals in a proprietary capacity. Pretty clear that they did it in a paramount capacity, which means that the exception doesn't apply, which means that in 1953, and the Submerged Land Act gave this riverbed from the federal government to the states, to the North State of North Dakota, which then gets us to the 89 Sovereign Lands Act, to the Furlong Mills, Mills 2, and REAP, 40 years of Supreme Court cases. So we've petitioned for rehearing on that basis. And again, I think we'll see what happens with that. I do think this Salerno approach by the Supreme Court here is something that you guys will be citing in facial challenges in North Dakota your whole careers. So with that, I want to thank you for having me. Does anyone have any questions?
All right. If there are no questions, thank you so much, Terry.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.